Good morning, afternoon, everyone. Welcome to eInform.org. I am Amy Sebring and will serve as your host and moderator today, and we are very glad you could join us. For any first-timers, we will be providing some instructions as we go along so you can relax and participate with us. We do want you to take part in the discussion. If you need assistance, please select the Help Desk from the drop-down options in the Q&A panel, and our associate, Lori Weaver, will try to assist you via private message. Now, today's topic is about enhancing coordination between military installations and civilian emergency management programs at the local level. This will become increasingly important as federal support for each may decline in the future. First, for the benefit of our newcomers, we will begin with an overview presentation, and then we will proceed to your questions or comments. We will provide further instructions just before we begin the Q&A, but we ask you not to submit your question or comment until we do get to that part of the program. Today's recordings and a copy of the slides will be available from our site later on this afternoon, and then a transcript should be available early next week. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce today's speaker. Ryan Broughton is the Emergency Management Program Manager at Davis Page Management Systems, LLC, where he continues to support implementation of the Army's Emergency Management Modernization Program. He previously led development of the Navy's Installation EM Program, developed the initial draft of the DoD Installation EM Program, and developed the Army's Emergency Management Program Manual for Headquarters, Department of the Army's Protection Division. Please see today's background page for further biographical details and links to several related resources, including websites related to each service branch and also military family preparedness. Welcome, Ryan. I am now turning the floor over to you to start us off, please.
Excellent. Good afternoon. Welcome to today's webinar. Glad to see so many friends online today. Two of the people at least online have heard a variation of this presentation before, but I hope we can still answer some unique questions and expand this so that we all learn something from today's webinar. Let me get started with kind of a description. When we talk about Department of Defense and the military, it is very common for people to think about defense support to civil authorities or civil support operations, where the military provides people in uniform, you know, what we call green gear, out in the field, helping the local community. And though that is an important part of the DoD's overall mission set, what we're talking about today is the installation environment. So we're going to be discussing the concept of jurisdictional emergency management on the Department of Defense installations. These installations are functionally equivalent to the cities and the towns that you're already familiar with: schools, childcare, gyms, shops, restaurants, airports, office buildings, gas stations, parks, and even Starbucks. We've got the exact same microcosm of civilian life just on a military installation. And the differences are the Department of Defense, a federal entity, owns these cities and operates these cities, and there is often a fence line demarking the jurisdictional boundaries. And each installation has defined missions to accomplish. And those missions might include aviation support, they might include power projection, but they might include test and evaluation of systems. We have to build stuff such as tanks and ships, and all those things require testing and maintenance and support, and those are done on installations as well. So not every installation is, you know, a whole load of tanks or carriers or submarines or marines ready to go into battle. This is an organization, a company, if you will. So keep in mind that the installations vary greatly, but I want you to focus in on the installation environment vice the civil support environment. One of our attendees today, Larry Porter, great and very knowledgeable in civil support. So if you have civil support questions, he's one of those people that you can reach out to. But I'm going to focus today on the installation environment. So we're going to go ahead and jump to the program overview, which is slide 3 and slide 4. So what gives us the authority to do this? In every plan, we always talk about the basis of authority for why and how we can do emergency management. Well, the Department of Defense has an overarching instruction, but then each service applies that basic program differently. The Air Force has a very different perspective of doing this than, say, the Navy or the Marine Corps or the Army. And so each of those services have their own EM program, Emergency Management Program, and those Emergency Management Programs focus on the local level, the installation environment, both inside and then how do we integrate with the outside, which is the key focus of today's discussion. Again, this is separate from civil support, so we're not talking about tanks and bulldozers and men in uniform, men and women in uniform going outside the gate. We're just talking about the installation environment. Our firefighters are largely civilian. Our law enforcement are civilian government uniform personnel and contractors. So we're not talking about just those green gear guys. We're talking about the entire installation environment. Development timeline, just gives you a kind of an idea on slide 5, how we progressed from, you know, NIMS in February of 2003 all the way to DPD 8 in 2011, and how DOD, Department of Defense, Army, Navy, U.S. Air Force, and U.S. Marine Corps have progressed. They've each approached this slightly different because they're different organizations. The Army program developed an Army regulation in 2009 and an Army manual in 2012. They also have, all the services have a community preparedness piece of that, like the ready.gov and those efforts with the Red Cross and with DHS to prepare the community as a whole. We have to prepare our military community for how to interface with us, what kind of warnings we will give them, how to take mass care actions, how to shelter in place, those kind of similar actions. Navy did the same thing. Navy program started a little before the DOD program. The Air Force program is an evolution of a program that had for many, many years, and they're the only ones that actually use military personnel in uniform to run their emergency management programs. All the other services use government civilian employees as the emergency managers. And in each of these cases, we're looking at an all-hazards type environment, all phases of emergency management, protecting the entire populace, not just looking at one piece of the mission or one piece of the threat spectrum like terrorism. And then each of those services come up with assessment criteria, readiness criteria, which is that bottom right box where they assess based on service-specific metrics. And those metrics tell us, for the amount of money we put in, we expect X amount of readiness out. And then we judge that readiness and then adjust the money accordingly to make sure that we're getting the right return on investment and that realizes our efficiencies. We hopefully draw down costs for doing this as we establish the programs and maintain them through their lifespan. Next slide. Slide 6 kind of gives you an idea of the scope. Many people have different opinions about what emergency management is. And for those of us in the Department of Defense, it's multi-agency and or multi-jurisdictional emergencies. And it's not just the people that we're concerned about. It's the mission, the personnel, and the property. And when I say multi-agency, a response by fire, public works, law enforcement, medical, and EMS on the base is multi-agency. If we're also pulling in mutual aid resources or we're responding to something that crosses both jurisdictions, whether it's a wildfire, a tornado, a chemical spill, a terrorist incident, those are multi-jurisdictional events. And we work across the entire life cycle, preparedness, prevention, mitigation, response, recovery. That prevention piece is very key, that we integrate with the force health protection and the anti-terrorism programs, as well as the information technology and cyber warfare, cyber terrorism programs, to look at the prevention piece as well. And this, the law, the legal basis for our activity is that enabling the government's responsibility to protect the installation against all hazards. And that's 50 U.S. Code Article 797. And that gives the installation commander the role, the responsibility, and the authority to protect the installation and its tenants. We couldn't do this without protecting our people and taking care of our people. And to do that, we communicate early and often throughout somebody's time on board the base, whether they just work on board, or we have housing areas where many of our uniform personnel have their families, their kids go to school on our bases, they go to child care and daycare facilities, they go to the pool, they go to the mall to go shopping. All of those things happen on board the installation. So we have a lot of effort made in community preparedness, that individual and family preparedness. And we couldn't do that if we didn't talk the same language. And NIMS provides us that language. Everybody talks about NIMS versus the National Response Framework. And for us, the NIMS is the common language. If we use NIMS the same way the outside defense line organizations and jurisdictions use NIMS, we can talk together when the time comes. We've exchanged business cards. We've exchanged plans. We've written the plans in similar formats. We've used similar language. We've used the same concept of resource typing. All of those efforts go to weave in those local organizations outside the fence line and weave in the bases that are nearby and supporting. For example, if you're in a place like D.C. or Hampton Roads, Virginia, or San Diego, California, or up in Seattle, you've got many bases weaved in together, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines. You also have the Defense Logistics Agency and other defense agencies that all have to work together. And then we do that by all that builds a coordinated response recovery capability. Common architecture, we support the National Response Framework. It gives us that architecture that we have to link into. And our real goal is to build a resilient installation. Shorten the response as much as possible, quicken the move to recovery, get those missions back online, get those people working. Those efforts only work if we have build a resilient installation. We have to build that resilience through our community programs. All right, so as I've said before, and I'm not going to belabor it, is the difference between civil support operations, where it's an additional duty to most of the assigned units, and emergency management, which is the primary duty. In emergency management, it can be performed by uniformed personnel, DOD civilians, DOD contractors. It doesn't matter. We are not just talking about the uniform side of it. Many of our emergency managers are DOD civilians. And then we also have to use resources like Incident Command System, and we have to meet OSHA and EPA guidelines because emergency management is not a unique, military-unique operation. So a military-unique operation like operating a carrier at sea, OSHA doesn't apply. OSHA is converted, basically, for that operating environment because, frankly, it's a very dangerous operating environment, and we don't exactly have all the same protections for somebody on the carrier that we do somebody working at a civilian airport. But in the case of emergency management, anti-terrorism, force protection, those types of work, we actually have to meet those same standards. So we don't use military, chemical, and biological protection because that gear is only set for a very, very small small hazard sector. It's only looking for things that are used in warfare. Well, frankly, there's a lot of things that aren't used in warfare that can still kill you, so we meet the OSHA and EPA guidelines as well. You look back on the left-hand side and you see the civil support. This is performed by the uniformed, active, reserve, and guard components. And the typical response, I'm going to exclude the guard for a minute, but the typical response for the uniformed, active, and reserve is in a last-in, first-out basis. We're not your first responder. We're not your mutual aid in terms of the uniformed personnel. You've been completely overwhelmed. There's nobody else that can do the job, and we've got that capability already sitting around. We use it in wartime. If we're not using it, we can leverage it to use it in the civilian sphere. And those resources don't use ICS at the individual level. They use ICS by becoming one task force answering to a joint task force, and that joint task force is the one that interfaces with, understands ICS, and translates basically from the civilian need, the civilian request for assistance, into the military mission assignment. And, of course, civil support is mobilized through the National Response Framework. There's also immediate response rule or immediate response authority for an installation to help a local environment if they need it. And it's very, very specific requests. It's very short time frame usually. Again, civil support is very different than emergency management. Think of us as the enablers. If we do our job right, the installation's up and running, the airfield's up and running, our fuel supply is up and running, we can support the uniformed personnel going outside the gate and helping our civilian counterparts. So to do that, we have to provide a comprehensive solution. Now, we use a lot of acronyms in the military, so I'm not going to try to use the acronyms so much as just focus on, well, we have to do all the preparedness activities that any other local jurisdiction would have to do. We have to plan, we have to train, equip, and exercise. And so we use some of the same systems. For example, in the Army, we're specifically looking at compliance with NFPA standards and EDXL, the Emergency Data Exchange Language, to ensure that our information and our material and our training is compatible with those outside the fence line. We adopt HSEAP. Almost all the installations have adopted HSEAP, the Homeland Security Exercise Evaluation Program. It is very similar to the programs we already use, but we've realigned to make sure, again, common terminology between our military installation and our civilian partners increases our readiness and allows us to exercise and be exercising to the same standards and the same requirements. And then the next slide talks, once we build that capability and preparedness, we've also got to continue to mitigate and prevent hazards and threats. And we do that through supporting continuity of operations, doing the same floodplain management, the same runoff management, all the same physical things we have to do in mitigation in a civilian world, we do in the military world. We just don't have to obey the interim final rule. We don't have a mitigation grant program. Those mitigation activities are funded actually by DOD, by the individual services. Same thing with prevention. There's no grant program for us to go and get additional capability. We do our budget and present that budget up to the services and request that money from Congress, just like any other federal department. And we respond. We have to build that resource management capability. And since our resources aren't EMACable, aren't transferable between states under the Emergency Management Assistance Compact, we use Tier 2 or non-national, state-local level resource type. We have the same support agreements, mutual aid, MOUs, memorandums of understanding, memorandums of agreement that the civilian world does. It's between the local jurisdiction and a federal entity. We have to have the same mass warning and notification systems, and we have to, of course, coordinate those because if we tell everybody to evacuate and the city doesn't, there's going to be a ghost evacuation in the city regardless of what we do. And guess where those people are going to go? They're going to come out of our fence line and go right through that same community. So we have to make sure those things are coordinated and we have interoperable communications. And just like everybody else, we have to recover. Again, the difference is we don't get any public assistance or any private assistance, individual assistance at all. There's no money that comes from FEMA to the base itself, the base residents. So if you are a family of a sergeant or a petty officer and you're living on board the base, when your house gets destroyed, the DOD, the Department of Defense, works to repair it. They identify the damage, they identify the cost, they manage the debris, and they end up paying for the rebuilding. If that same family lives out in the local community just outside the fence, they're eligible for FEMA assistance and any assistance provided by the state, even Red Cross. Red Cross does not have a charter to, or mandate, I should say, to operate on the military installations. So the mass care that they're receiving outside is through Red Cross and Salvation Army and organizations such as the ENZOAD. Whereas inside the fence line, you're talking about the military taking care of the military, taking care of the people that are on those bases. And we do that in the exact same environment as you see on slide 10. We're doing the same all-hazards environment, natural, technological, intentional, terrorism. It doesn't matter. The goal of emergency management is to build capabilities that work regardless of what the hazard is. So we're not a scenario-based program. We don't sit there and go, here are our 15 little planning scenarios that are all national-level catastrophic events. We build capabilities for that Type 3 incident, that local incident, and we build that interface so that we can accept that help from the state from the federal government, from other federal entities, if we need it. This really requires that mutual support. You cannot do emergency management functionally on an installation without that mutual support with our local community. And we are part of the local community, as you see on slide 11. There's over 200 DOD installations, 85% of the overall total. 40,000, almost 5,000 facilities just located inside the United States and its territories and possessions. And some of those installations are 100 people. Some of them are 150,000 people. So there's a large variation in what we call an installation. And we're talking about 300,000 buildings at 5,000 locations on over 20 million acres of land. It is a huge enterprise when you look at the number of bases, the number of people, the differences in those installations and environments. We are your neighbors. We're the people that are right there next to you, working beside you. All we need to do is, just like other local jurisdictions, become part of that regional environment so that we can call upon you just like you call upon us. So how do we integrate? How do we increase that integration? Well, on slide 13, you'll see the start of some concepts that we have, things that are pretty good integration areas. Many of them represent challenges for us. You know, developing mechanisms for sharing unclassified common operating picture across jurisdictions. Oh, it sounds pretty easy. Many local jurisdictions do that today. But the military has developed a large body of regulations and a body of experience regarding how we prepare for cyber incidents, how we protect our IT infrastructure. And it is harder than you would believe to share a common picture between one jurisdiction, military, and another jurisdiction, which is civil. And it's one of the things we deal with as almost a daily challenge. We have to provide that support across the fence line in both directions. It's not enough for a local jurisdiction, a local city, to say, hey, we need your fire department. Okay, but we need your fire department too. There are times when we're going to share those resources in both directions. And the real goal here is setting good expectations management. The other EM, as I tend to call it, the ability to make sure that the other EOCs that you're working with understand what you can and can't do. You can't just call us and say, I need the 1st Infantry Division to come out here and haul away all this debris because I can't afford to pay anybody. Huh? That's illegal. I can't do that. We got to set those expectations early on. That's how we exercise. That's how we train. We bring people across the fence line in order to do that. And that's going to build that relationship and build that trust. So when the EOC is stood up, everybody has the same expectations. And other integration opportunities, things like force protection conditions, something we learned well from Fort Hood. When you set, we have a thing called a threat force protection condition, or FPCON. We have to have an acronym, of course, for everything. That force protection condition delta is a complete lockdown of the base. Well, unfortunately, unless you practice it, when you lock down the base, you lock out all the local first responders just as much as all the other people because they're all stuck in the exact same traffic. And at Fort Hood, that caused us to have a large number of helicopter evacuations that we normally wouldn't have to hospitals that we didn't maintain a good expectations management, a good relationship with. And it became very difficult to track our casualties through the incident. We want to make sure that the ambulances, the fire trucks, the police can get on the base at the exact same time we're trying to get non-essential personnel off the base or evacuated. And that goes into the evacuation management. Again, we have to coordinate evacuation routes. And it's not just enough to coordinate it with the first city, but with the state as a whole, because you're dumping a large percentage of a working population in many, many cars, not a lot of mass transit at many of these bases, and you're dumping them out into those roadways, and they need to capture that. See, the problem is that programs like FERM, the federal flood insurance rate maps, those aren't done for the military installations. And funnily enough, they're done by the same organization, but the Army, Navy, the Air Force, Marines have to pay to get those done separately for those installations. And in many cases, the hurricane evacuation studies have never included those military populations, or they've included only the uniformed population without looking at the entire working population of the base. In both cases, we need to ensure that we coordinate our evacuation needs. We've resolved those legal challenges before we exercise those capabilities as well, because unlike the civilian world, when the military commander, the installation commander, evacuates their people, they have to pay for it. They have to start paying for those people's per diem, for their travel, for their costs incurred during that evacuation. Then we've talked a little about mass care. Mass care is also a challenge because, you know, we don't have civilian shelters on most of these installations. Most of the military programs call them safe havens because they don't meet the ARC and DHS definitions of what a shelter is. And we're pretty good at putting people up and making tent cities and making additional mass care facilities, but we have a long way to go in how do we communicate that to our people? How do we make sure that we meet at least the same intent, if not the same actual legal capability that Red Cross or Salvation Army needs? Now, on slide 15, one of our growing challenges is public-private ventures. Believe it or not, there are schools on board bases that are actually county or city schools. And there are county and city kids who go to school there every day, come on board the base in a bus, go to school, and have to come off the base. They have no affiliation with the military. The base just happens to host the school. And we also have housing areas that we have we've had trouble finding the resources to maintain, so we've leased them out to private companies, and then we provide a guarantee, say 80% capacity. And those housing areas, though, are on the physical installation. And if we don't meet that 80% capacity, they turn around and they rent it out to civilians who have no military affiliation. We give them a little pass so they can get through the gate. But functionally, they are local citizens, private citizens, living on a military installation. Again, a challenge when you lock that gate, you're impacting somebody who doesn't have a military affiliation. And so those support agreements, both on and off the base, become very important. Many of the bases have a lot of tenants, and some of those tenants don't even work for the Department of Defense. You come to some bases, especially along the border, and you might find Border Patrol, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, all sorts of different groups working on the same base. And so we have to create agreements and understanding, set those expectations again between us and the tenants about what they can expect from us during an emergency and what we need them to do. And one of those largest tenants is the medical community. Medical and public health is usually owned by another command, and they provide the hospital or the clinic services on that base. And those military treatment facilities, military hospitals, have to coordinate with the local hospitals because public health surveillance, again, will not help you if you're only monitoring your side of the fence line. We have to look both sides of the fence line. We have to share the hospital availability so that we ensure that we have that capacity, that capability when the time comes. And slide 16 gives you an idea about emergency communications. Again, we can't do any of that coordination without those communications. And as we move to the trunk radio systems that are now required, we find that we actually lose interoperability with the local community. And we have to, again, address those challenges and find ways to maintain or strengthen our interoperable communications. And those communications come to, you know, a head in the node that we have, which is called an installation dispatch center. Now, in occasional places, in the Army, it's 16, 17 places in the entire Army, we have public safety answering points that meet the same qualifications as your civilian counterparts. But in many cases, we have dispatch centers that only get a select number of the 911 calls, and many of the wireless 911 calls go off base and then get routed back onto the installation for response. So we have to coordinate that handover process as well. And we've got to ensure that those people can rapidly initiate mass warning and notification. We say mass warning and notification because we do mass warning for our populace, doing those protective actions. What do we tell people? We tell people to either stay where they are, move a little, move a lot, keep moving, and evacuate. And those are simple messages. so that we don't, again, we don't want to cloud the issue with, oh, was it a terrorist incident or was it a non-terrorist incident? Who cares? We need to tell them, are you going to shelter in place? Are you going to lock down? Are you going to go home and do residential sheltering? Are you going to go to a safe haven that we designate? Are you going to go off base to maybe another location, a civilian location, or potentially all the way to another base? Every time there's a hurricane, Corpus Christi and the area has all the military bases packed up and all those residents move up to San Antonio. Same concept happens throughout. Marines have had a great example of that in Georgia just recently. And to do that, we need to coordinate with IPAWS because as those people move from one location to another, we're going to have to rely on IPAWS to provide that infrastructure. Once they leave their desk, once they leave their building, we start losing modes of communication to them. And as we lose those modes, we need to expand our reach. And IPAWS provides that for not only us, but for all the civilian counterparts as well. What better way to be interoperable if you're than use the exact same method for mass warning? We also do the notification piece. How do you activate your installation EOC? How do you activate the Family Assistance Center? How do you activate the damage assessment team? Well, you have to have very quick notification methods, and we use the exact same system for both avenues, both mass warning and the tailored notification to select populace. So let's talk about quickly the best practices, and we'll get into the best part of this, which is the Q&A. Some best practices that we've seen, the work that has been done, BioWatch is the civilian version, and BioNet is the DoD version, trying to integrate sensor technologies. The DoD and civil integration under OCTEMA IPAWS, what we just talked about. The exercise programs, making sure that the military installations in those local environments participate fully with the state and local exercises. Absolutely critical. If you're not exercising those capabilities don't exist. Many of the bases have created shared use of civilian-owned web EOC systems. Whether it's view-only or full access, there is a growing trust among the civilian community to trust the installation with that information, with visibility of that information, and it streamlines those resource requests both in and outside the fence line. Some of the DoD installations have achieved the National Weather Service Storm Ready designation, especially important, the Air Force has done a lot of work with the National Weather Service on things like Storm Ready designation. And we've got installations in school systems developing CERT teams to leverage that capability, that capacity within the community. What are some of the best practices that we see? Well, again, that Air Force warning coordination with National Weather Service is by far the best of all the four services. The Marine Corps has got a great program called the Marine Corps Task Force for Emergency Response, MCTIFER. And it started at Camp Lejeune in December of 1999 and is rapidly growing to be a perfect example of what an installation can do when they actively engage with the civilian environment, with the local civil jurisdictions. Again, the Air Force has a certified emergency management program. There's lots of legal reasons why, but there isn't a lot of integration, though many emergency managers within DoD have joined IEM and have become CEM. There isn't a mechanism to mandate that and acknowledge that throughout the entire Department of Defense. So the Air Force has their own certified emergency management program that was developed in conjunction with IEM. Very, very good program that many of the other services are looking at as a model. Air Force and Navy have standardized mutual aid templates and shared those among both the Air Force and the Navy installations. In fact, recently the Army adopted one of those same templates so that we start having the same language, the same discussion with our civilian partners. Naval Submarine Base Teams Bay in Georgia, great mutual aid system. Heavily dependent on a local environment, and very, very good coordination. Again, a great example of best practice for all the installations to look at and all the local communities to look at. And in the Army, we have the Army EM Modernization Program, which is focused on procuring three material systems, Common Operating Picture, Mass Warning Notification, and Enhanced 911, and fielding those to select installations where there's gaps, where they don't have that ability right now to share information between the military jurisdiction and the civil jurisdiction. where they don't have that ability to warn their populace effectively or notify their teams, and where they don't have the ability to capture that automatic number identification, automatic location information, and the alley data necessary to quickly enhance the response, the dispatch of those fire and emergency services and law enforcement resources to an incident. And then the Army Installation Level Resource Packing Initiative, again, we've talked about the NIMS Tier 2 resource types, ones that are not EMACable among the states. And we've done quite a bit of work in the Army to resource type. We've got 22 capabilities that we type that are type resources assigned to our typed installations. So we have Type 1, Type 2, Type 3 installations, and they're required to develop Type 1, Type 2, and Type 3 respectively, resources. And those resources run the gamut from your installation EOC team to certain types of response resources, all the way through mass care, evacuation, and, of course, recovery, such as the damage assessment teams, debris management teams, structural evaluation. So those are some best practices that we've seen across DOD. There's many others, but this gives you an idea of what we're trying to do to build that bridge and integrate with the local community. And some lessons learned, as you see on slide 20, one of the challenges, of course, that each service has its own lessons learned system. So we have to then work at the headquarters level. We have an emergency management steering group for the entire service, and then we have an emergency management steering group across all the services and the Department of Defense activities, like the Defense Logistics Agency. And that gives us a chance to every month come together, talk about what we're doing, learn from each other, and also find out how can we apply a lesson that might have happened to, say, the Marine Corps. How do we apply that in the Army? Because we don't have visibility on their lessons learned, but they can identify those things that they see as having applicability across the Department of Defense. And those are some of the things we've had challenges with. You know, the Joint Commission standards, I think we've come a long way in doing that. The medical community is really engaged in it. But we've had, meanwhile, quite a bit of difficulty integrating our trunk radio systems because we have two different frequency spectrums. We have a lot of challenges using volunteers. There's a specific clause, 31 U.S. Code 3142, that actually prohibits us from using some of those volunteer resources unless it's an emergency. So we've gone through a long legal process of how do we define that emergency, how do we declare that emergency so that it's clear that we can use those resources, but then how do we use those resources in training and exercises well before the emergency exists. And, of course, that reimbursement mechanism for mutual aid continues to hamper a lot of reimbursement across the fence line because we have to cost what these things, resources cost the Department of Defense. And that is not something that we've been traditionally strong about, but something that we can definitely push on and make happen in the world. And, of course, those mass warning notification timelines. Our mass warning notification timeline is 10 minutes from the incident. Well, that can be hard when you're doing a parachute drop at Fort Bragg. How do you notify somebody who's in that process? Downrange, how do you notify them? How do you engage them in that 10 minutes? Well, we have that same challenge engaging the people that are at the commissary, our grocery store, our exchange, which is our mall, or even at their homes or at their place of business. So those are some of the lessons learned that we continue to learn. We're not just watching them as the lessons fly by. We're trying to apply those into how we develop our policy, how we execute our policy, and how we implement the programs at the installation level. So we get to the good part that took about the right amount of time. So I guess we'll talk about the questions. Amy, is there any?
Thank you very much, Ryan. I was particularly interested to learn about some of the unique challenges that these installations face. And we will move on to our Q&A. To ask a question or make a comment, please select host from the drop-down menu in the Q&A panel and then type in the area underneath. And you'll see I've already closed the chat panel, so you can find the Q&A panel easily. Please do keep your question or comment related to today's topic and reasonably concise. And if you have specific experience in your own communities, I'm sure Ryan would be glad to hear about it. We all would be glad to hear about it as well. We are ready to begin now, so please enter your comment or question at any time. I've got a couple up here, but first I quickly wanted to ask you, because I had this question in mind for you, Ryan. You mentioned that there are some MAA or MOA templates that some of the services are using.
Yes.
Yes. Are links to those available anywhere? I mean, are those published? I was just going to ask to follow up with you if, you know, if I could find some links to that. I would like to get those.
Yes. The Army one is online with the – it's in the Army Emergency Management Program Manual.
Okay.
So if you go in the resources section and you click on the link for Army Policy, at the very bottom of that page there's a link to the – DA, Department of the Army, pamphlet, that's what we call a manual, DA pamphlet 525-27. And that is the Army's Emergency Management Program Manual. That has an example of the overarching template that we use. I'll have to find out if the Navy or the Air Force has a distinct link to those, or if those are still kind of internal assets. What we don't necessarily want to do is we're not trying to initiate this conversation from the civilian side with our template. We're trying to make sure that the installations use our template in their discussions with the civilian environment. But absolutely good point. I'll follow that up.
All right. Thank you. I'll follow it up as well. And I do believe I do have the link, direct link to the Army manual on our background page already. Okay. I have Jeff Hoyle. And can you discuss plans for DOD emergency management to leverage Unified Incident Command Decision Support System, that's also known as USID, that's a DHS program, to facilitate interoperability between DOD installation emergency managers and local civil emergency managers? And that's if you know, Ryan. Are you familiar with USID?
Jeff, great question. There are some installations that are trying to apply that to see how we leverage USID into the way we do it on our military installation. I think there's definitely a lot of growth that can happen there and a lot of use of that those tools, but I don't know of any installation emergency management program in the services that is actually formally provided guidance to the installations. It's one of the challenges, of course, with DHS is keeping up with DHS. DHS will change things literally as we wrote, for example, the Army EM program manual. They came out with PPD-8. They changed a lot of the terminology and a lot of the environment. And we had that same problem when we developed the Navy program. We developed the Navy program. When we started working on them, there wasn't anything called National Incident Management System. It was a few pieces of paper in an HSPD. So we do have that problem of how do we quickly capture it and integrate it. So thanks for bringing that up. I'm going to follow that up on my side within the Army program, and I'll recommend it across the DOD. Thank you. I really appreciate you bringing that up, Jeff.
Very good. Nice comment here from Gary Weeks, and he says, presentations like this should be offered at each state's emergency management conference, such as the Texas EM conference being conducted March 25th through 29th, plug for Texas. DOD should be attending these conferences to meet their counterparts.
Absolutely agree with you, Gary. The challenge we have on these state EM conferences is, frankly, we've got more conferences than we have people to present at them. Now, each of the installations are encouraged to participate within their local, state, and regional conferences. But as you might be aware of, there's sequestration, and right now we don't have travel to virtually any conference or workshop. We've canceled almost everything that we do that way and gone to webinars and teleconferences, which are, of course, not nearly as efficient as that face-to-face, long-term relationship that you can build. I just came from San Antonio before I moved back up here to D.C., and was at the Texas EM conference last year. I, in fact, asked about providing the same type of lecture there, and there wasn't a lot of interest, and a lot of that is because they don't understand the difference between a DOD installation and civil support. They said, look, we've got plenty of people from the National Guard and talking about what the National Guard does. And we've got NORTHCOM briefing, and we've got Army North briefing from San Antonio. And those were all great presentations, but they aren't necessarily about how you build that relation with the installation. But I'll definitely take that back and bring that up. Thanks again. That's another great comment.
And let me follow up on that one just slightly. I mean, do you have any knowledge or guess, if worst comes to worst, what the sequester and the new budget impact is going to be on these emergency management programs for the military?
Well, for the EM program, I can only talk directly to one program, which is this time the Army EM program, you know, has taken millions of dollars in cuts because of sequester. And there was actually another cut of our DOD funding even before sequestration went into effect. So there have been a number of cuts. However, we have managed to protect so far the civilian pay, the training, those efforts, including things like the Emergency Management Modernization Program. However, almost at least within the Army, I believe in the DOD-wide, we are in a complete travel ban.
Right.
Unless you really, really have a great reason to be there, they're not going to send anybody to a conference, not send anybody to a workshop. And you can see this all the way back for those people like Larry and Gene and others who were at the IEM conference this year. We had to turn away, we had 500 military people coming to IEM when we talked in September. When the actual IEM conference happened, most of the travel bans had already gone in effect. And so we actually turned away 48 people from the Air Force, and that was after they canceled probably 200 sets of orders. The Army, same thing. Navy, Marine Corps lost a lot of attendance because those travel bans have really affected our participation in those local environments. We understand how important it is. But at this point, they need to emphasize. We emphasize the need to build those and maintain those relationships at the local level, where there's no travel required until we restore at least a semblance of travel authority.
Right. Thank you. Larry Porter says, I suggest you inform the audience about the recently released February 2013 ALSA, Air, Land, Sea Application, lots of acronyms here, MTTP, Multi-Service Tactics, Techniques, and Procedures Publication, DSCA. It's available at, and he has a URL.
And there's also a draft Multi-Service Tactics, Techniques, and Procedures Publication for EM. So, again, those are great resources that we need to add into that resource list.
I will do on the background page as best I can. Okay, I have Robert McCrate, and he asks, how will differences between Air Force, Navy, and Army in doctrine and common EM training be handled?
Robert, that's a million-dollar question. In fact, the Army just directed Training and Doctrine Command to do a study on that relationship, not only between the other services, but also between civil support operations and emergency management operations. You know, find those efficiencies. How can we combine classes? How can we combine the online training? How can we combine the certification process? The Air Force has a very, very rigorous training program that actually starts at the hazardous materials response, chem bio, rad nuke, incident response levels. And their emergency management cadre start out as responders. And that's an enlisted cadre of personnel. So these are enlisted uniform personnel, active, reserve, and guard, who first learn how to do CBRN detection, plume modeling, you know, focused on the CBRN hazards. And then as they progress up their chain, they widen their aperture to an all-hazards environment, first at the unit level and eventually, like unit level being like the departmental operations centers, finally up to that installation emergency operations center level. So Air Force is quite different. The Navy and the Army have quite a few similarities in that some of the training materials, some of the policies have been, you know, been shared and then expanded upon by both of the services. a lot of that, of course, is because some of the people that are now implementing the Army program came from the Navy Inflation EM program and carried some of that with them. I think what we see is that the fact that we have a DoD installation EM program now since 2009 that helps us standardize what those expectations are, I think you're going to see Air Force, Navy, Army, Marine Corps, Defense Logistics Agency that runs installations come up to some kind of common EM standard. And it's taken its time, but as I said, there's a new multi-service TTP that's tactics and procedures doctrine that's coming out that will apply to all four of the services. So it is happening. It's just taking time.
Very good. Here's a good question from J.R. Thomas, who asks, would you please discuss challenges when holding a joint civilian-military exercise on a military installation?
I think one of the big challenges is breaking down that perceived roadblock. Many of the military leadership, initially, they don't want to reveal the true limitations. That's always something that's held close to the chest when the military are talking to other components, other jurisdictions, is, you know, here's our strengths, and we're not going to talk about our weaknesses. And, of course, exercises have a tendency to show those weaknesses, show those capabilities and limitations. And I think it's very important to engage that military installation very early on, that the goal here is to strengthen, to get rid of those limitations and strengthen our capabilities across the board, and to show how, from both sides of the fence, how this benefits readiness. And if you tie those exercises with a local military jurisdiction to readiness, to this, doing this exercise will help you in your readiness, help you develop capability on your side of the fence as well as ours. I think that's the way we have to start selling it to our installation leadership, the installation commanders. They're very eager to take part in this, and there's a lot of command pressure from the headquarters to take part in these local jurisdictional exercises. But again, you gotta engage them very early, get them to understand the reason, the benefit to them in doing this exercise, and then make sure that they're part of that from the initial planning conference on. If you engage them at the MPC or the FPC of the conference and you say, oh, I just want you guys to respond, and hey, can you send out some tanks and some bulldozers and some men, and they're going to say no, because that's not what we're exercising. We don't exercise the civil support function the same way we exercise the installation emergency management function. If you start with the installation EM function, getting fire, police, EMS, public works, types of resources to work across the fence line, you'll build that relationship, and eventually you can get authority to actually have the civil support capability exercise. But I'd start with that inflation EM1. That's where the command emphasis is.
Great. We've got still several comments, so we're probably not going to get to everybody today, but we'll do our best. Robert McCrate asks, is there an annual mechanism for information sharing on best practices between the Air Force, Navy, and Army on best practices and continuing issues?
There is. There's actually a monthly DOD-wide EM steering group, and that EM steering group there are representatives from each of the four services, plus Defense Logistics Agency, Pentagon Force Protection Agency, Defense Threat Reduction Agency, and a couple other cats and dogs that contribute. And those services and agencies all share their experiences, what their challenges are. And that's a venue that we can share lessons learned, and we have shared lessons learned and best practices across. So, yes, that mechanism exists. There's no documented, you have to submit your lessons learned every year to the other services. So it's solely a getting them in the same room and getting them talking on those subjects.
Is there any movement to expand that Air Force CEM program to the other branches that you know?
When you say the Air Force one, if you mean the Air Force CEM, the Certified Emergency Manager?
Yes.
The Army is in talks with the Air Force about leveraging that same concept. I will say that the biggest challenge is that the Air Force, unlike the other four services, has a enlisted career field. And they have three levels of their CEM, and only one of them does emergency management. The others do emergency response. And we have to find a way to tailor how the Air Force, that top layer, their certified emergency management, links into and making sure that we have the right terminology in there. And then, of course, somebody has to pay for it. So,
right.
You know, if any other service tacks on that additional workload, we have to figure out what that workload is and how to fund it. But it is something that we've discussed the past year, and I think something that will happen in the future.
Very good. Okay. I have a question from Robert Rathbone from Florida Army Mars. Who would I contact at a local Air Force base to get plugged into the base's resources to help solve the bridge between the two radio systems? And we're not asking you for the name of a specific person, but, you know, generally speaking.
Well, every Air Force base worldwide has an emergency manager. They have it's called the Readiness Flight, and they are under the civil engineer for the base. So if you look up on the base directory or you contact the base, what you're looking for is the chief of the Readiness Flight.
Flight, and L-I-H-T, right, okay.
Yes. And I'll just spell it out real quick on the little Q&A thing. So that Readiness Flight is who they need to contact. Now, they're going to refer you to some other communications folks probably, but that's a good place to start. They're your entryway into that military emergency management program.
Very good. Okay, question from Scott Hipaka, and again, everybody, I beg your indulgence if I mispronounce names. He says, Ryan, much of your discussion was focused on DOD active duty installations. What are you hearing or seeing regarding NGB's guidance for the way forward with the National Guard installations that are managed each state, if you know, Ryan?
Well, yeah. We in fact, had that discussion just yesterday. We were having a discussion about how this applies differently to the National Guard versus an active installation. The National Guard for the Army, and I'll specify for the Army just because that's the one I'm most familiar with. So you're talking about 43 to 4,400 facilities within the U.S., its territories and possessions. They still, so if you're just talking about an armory, a physical building, what we call a facility versus an installation, they're getting their emergency resources largely from the civilian jurisdiction. And we consider those a Type 3 installation. And those Type 3 installations, their requirement is to build that awareness and build that capability to call upon the locals for help and call upon any supporting military installations for assistance. Whereas there are National Guard camps that are physical installations with their own fire departments. And though those are rare, that's the most exact replica of the active duty component and the reserve component installations. But the National Guard has also moved to a state virtual installation model where they have a kind of a state virtual installation garrison commander, a garrison command structure. I shouldn't say garrison commander. But garrison command structure, and that helps manage all the facilities and camps within those state boundaries. The same rules apply, the same needs to build capability and capacity apply. It's just very often they're leveraging their relationship with their local civil jurisdiction instead of actually building that capability, that capacity inside their fence line.
I think I've got time for one last question. And, folks, I'm going to be putting up the feedback form, and if we didn't get to your question today, go ahead and type it into that feedback form, and we'll make sure that Ryan sees it. This is from Ava Jean, and she says, thanks, Ryan. Regarding individual and family preparedness on military installations, how is the preparedness training provided? What types of topics are taught? And do these serve folks well when they no longer live on a base but live in local communities?
The quick answer, knowing that we're out of time, is the Ready Army, Ready Navy, Ready Marine Corps, all of those programs they're very closely tied to what's put out in the civilian environment, but they're tailored to the military environment. They're not going to FEMA. They're not going to Red Cross necessarily. They're going to the base.
And that's really why we have those programs, is to build that relationship, show how we provide those same services. There's no loss of services. In fact, in some cases, I would argue, especially with damage assessment and financial assistance, we're a hell of a lot better and more streamlined than the FEMA program, mainly because we don't have to go through the same process. We're not, these are people we know, people that we ask to live there, and it's our responsibility to help them. So I think it builds a good basis, a good foundation. We keep the same ideas about a minimum of 72 hours of readiness, of personal preparedness. We talk about the same needs for how you shelter in place, how you go to a civilian shelter. All those issues are still discussed, but we then provide them localized hazard guidance as well as that information on how to tap into our mass warning notification system. How do you subscribe to alerts, and how do you maintain that communications link with the installation? There's some links in the resources to Ready Army and the other.
Exactly. All the sites, all the branches.
So I think, Abhijit, that our goal here is just to ensure that those people are reached with that information. Since Red Cross doesn't have that charter, Red Cross may or may not provide any information, but they're without a doubt not going to provide tailored information about how we do things on base. How do you get food? How do you get water? How do you get clothes? How do you do donations management? How do you volunteer to help? We have unique laws, unique policies, unique procedures, and we need to communicate those to our jurisdiction.
All right, we are definitely out of time. So on behalf of Ava Jean, myself, and all our participants today, thank you very much, Ryan, for joining us and sharing this information and your insights. And we wish you continued success in the future as you move forward with this support. Folks, before you go, please do take a moment to give us some feedback. And, again, like I said, if you had additional questions, you can put them in there. Our next program is scheduled for March 24th, when we are very excited to present an update on the status of the Public Safety Broadband Network. Our guest will be FirstNet board member Kevin McGinnis, so please make plans to join us then and watch for our announcement. In the meantime, for the mathematically inclined, have a happy Pi Day tomorrow, and for the Irishly inclined, have a happy St. Patrick's Day. Have a great afternoon, everyone. We are adjourned. Thank you.